Okay, well, thank you all for being here tonight. And thank you, everybody, for the introductions and Ali for that excellent opener. I agree with Ali completely. I think things are extremely depressing and extremely severe and serious in Israel and Palestine. But I also agree with him that there is a lot of hope. I'm over the last 2.5 weeks, I've been to a Sabil conference, the Russell Tribunal of Palestine, and the Presbyterian Church, Israel-Palestine Mission Network, which are all people who live in this country, who for by and large don't necessarily have anything to do with Israel or Palestine, but care enough to put in the time and the effort and the funds to bring about change. And that is exactly, that is precisely why there's hope. I usually begin my presentations with a disclaimer saying that my presentation is not a balanced one. I think today things are a little bit different, and I will venture to think that this is going to be a balanced presentation because, thankfully, we have Israelis and we have Palestinians and we have American Jews. And I think more often than certainly I would like to see, this conversation or the people who engage in this conversation, participate in panels and talks, are either American Jews who don't live in Palestine or Israelis like myself, who are children of colonizers. Either way, it's not our country to discuss, and there needs to be a Palestinian presence that can, you know, be part of this conversation about the future of that country. So I'd like to put that out front, so I'm really glad that we have this this joint effort in organizing this and also to have Ali here between Brant and I. There are a lot of myths, a lot of double standards on this issue. I'm sure most of you are familiar with them. Ali touched on the issue of the right of return, and I want to just say one quick thing about that as I begin. I think of all the double standards and all the ridiculous double standards that exist on this issue, the right of return is probably the biggest. The whole notion of the state of Israel, the whole notion of Zionism is the right of return. It's a right of return of a people to their land. Except these are not the people who actually ever lived in that land. These are people who claim some kind of a connection to people who used to live there several thousand years ago. Yet today in the world, Zionism is an accepted, a completely accepted idea, and the notion of Jews returning to their homeland is a perfectly acceptable idea. But when we talk about Palestinians, then suddenly this is completely unacceptable and it has to be taken off the table. Palestinians who were forced to move out of their land, many of them are still alive. This was only 65 years ago. And if they passed away, certainly their descendants are alive. Many of them have the keys and the deeds to their homes. And for some reason, this happens to be this one of these issues that everybody raises a red flag and say, oh, no, 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 we cannot talk about the right of return of the Palestinians. And of course, this is a terrible double standard. I think it's important to go back a little bit and touch on the history, and that's what I'm going to do. Because once again, the mythology begins with the history of the conflict. First of all, when people say the conflict has been going on for so long that really there's no hope because it's been thousands and thousands of years. That place has been, you know, a victim of wars and these people have been killing each other forever and ever. And I think a good place to start this conversation is exactly on November the 29th, 1947, when the United Nations came up with this ridiculous map, which is the partition plan. And it's a plan whereby the United Nations, first of all, assumed that it had the right to partition somebody else's land. On top of that, as there were two communities living in that part in Palestine at the time, a small Jewish community of about 500,000 and a large Palestinian community of about 1.5 million, the United Nations decided to give a larger portion of the country to the smaller Jewish community and a smaller portion to the larger Palestinian community. And somebody really thought this was going to work. I mean, somebody really thought, and to this day you hear people say, well, the Palestinians did not accept the partition plan, so all of this is their fault. Why would they accept it? Why in the world should they have accepted it if they did or not? And then, of course, the story is that as soon as the United Nations finally recognized the rights of the Jews to have their own state, the Arabs attacked. The Arabs attacked immediately with the intention of destroying this fledgling state, this Jewish entity, and this is only several years after the Holocaust. But when we look at these two communities, we see something very interesting. There are two communities who were, you know, expecting to become a state, but there was one thing that the Zionist community in Palestine developed that the Palestinians did not. And that was a fighting force. By that time, the Zionist militias numbered close to 40,000 fighting men. They were armed, they were very well trained. My father was one of them. They were very well indoctrinated, believing in the cause of Zionism. But there was no equivalent on the Palestinian side. There was no militia, there was no army. In fact, Palestinians have never had an army. So who are these Arabs that attacked? We know that the Arab countries like Egypt and the others didn't attack until after May, so 6 or 7 months later, May of 1948. So in that period, who are these Arabs that attacked? And then once again, as we take a closer look at what actually took place, we see that it was the Zionist militias who attacked with the intention, a very clear intention, of a very systematic campaign of ethnic cleansing to drive out the Palestinians from their homes and from their land so that the Jews would have a larger portion of the country and somehow create a majority that would justify this. The way I came about to write my book has a lot to do with my own personal story and things that I heard from my parents and things that I heard from my family as well as my own research. And one of the interesting stories and the thing that I hear a lot after my lectures, people come up and talk to me about, is a story about my mother. This is her when she was young. She's 86 years old. She was born and raised in Jerusalem. She still lives in Jerusalem. And when she was 1948, she was 22 years old. And the war was going on. The Palestinian communities in Jerusalem were taken over by the Zionist militia, the Zionist forces, and forced to leave. And when I mention Jerusalem, I'm talking not about the old city of Jerusalem. I'm talking about the neighborhoods outside the wall, kind of the western, modern side of the city. And when the Palestinians were forced to leave, their homes, which stand to this day, these are beautiful neighborhoods that people who know Jerusalem know them well, were offered to Israeli families. And my mother, whose husband was, fighting for the Zionist cause, he was in the front, she had two young children, she was living in a small apartment, and she was offered one of those homes. And her reaction to this day when I talk to her about this, and we talk about this a lot, is always the exact same reaction. How could I possibly take the home of another family? How could I possibly move into the home of another mother? And every single time I tell the story, I have somebody in the audience come up and tell me, my family had a home in one of those neighborhoods in Jerusalem. And all these years, and she told me the story when I was a child, I remember it, growing up, and something about the story always bothered me, and I couldn't figure out what it was until I was actually working on the book, and I couldn't reconcile the problem. And the problem was that her story was contradicting the national narrative. It was contradicting the story that I'd heard in school, that I'd heard all around me, which is the Arabs attacked, we miraculously won, and then the Arabs all left. The Arabs are what Zionists call the Palestinians. Well, if that's the case, what's the problem? Why couldn't she take the home? There's no moral issue here. If they attacked, we, and then they left after we won. But that's not what she was saying. She was saying there's another issue here. There is a moral issue here. And again, like I said, it wasn't until much later on that I was able to actually reconcile this. So at the end of what we call, the Israelis call the War of Independence, the Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe, this is what the map looked like. Israel has taken over almost 80% of the country, leaving the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And then 20 years later, the drums of war were beating again, and war was on the horizon. This is the leading up to the 1967 Six-Day War. And if you recall, what initiated this was when the Egyptian President Nasser decided to bring his forces into the Sinai Peninsula. As you can see on the map, the Sinai Peninsula keeps the two countries apart, Israel and Egypt. And he kicked out the UN peacekeeping forces, and he also threatened to close the Straits of Tiran, which are circled on the map, and lead up to the city of Eilat, which is an important port city. The Israeli top brass, the Israeli general, saw this as a legitimate cause for war and began pressing for war. This was in the spring of 1967. And throughout the spring and the beginning of summer, they were pushing and pressing and pushing and pressing for war. Now, in the research that I did, part of what I was able to do is go into the Israeli army archives to learn about my father's military career. He was a general. But particularly what I wanted to see were the minutes of the meetings of the generals leading up to the war, to this Six-Day War. Because the story that we hear once again, same as in 1947-48, is that the Arabs attacked. The Arabs were intending to destroy the state of Israel, and they attacked, and again, miraculously, we won. But when I was reading the minutes of the meetings, of the generals, what they were saying was that the Egyptian army is not prepared for war. In fact, the Egyptian army needs at least a year and a half to 2 years to be prepared for war. So we have another opportunity right now to destroy the Egyptian army. Not only was there no existential threat, there was no threat at all. This was an opportunity to once again display Israeli might and to gain a military victory. So there was this debate between the top brass of the army and the cabinet whether or not to begin the war, but finally the cabinet gave the okay. The Israeli military began a preemptive strike against Egypt, and the battle against Egypt went very well. Over several days, the whole Sinai Peninsula was taken, and the Egyptian army was destroyed. Now the generals wanted more. These generals were the young commanders in 48, and they were very upset that the West Bank was not included in the State of Israel. And now they had an opportunity, since the momentum was already there with war, to take the West Bank. And so they did. And then to take the Golan Heights, which was another area that they'd wanted for a very long time. And so they did. Now, in 6 days, all that territory was conquered. The Israeli army managed to destroy three Arab armies, killing over 15,000 Arab soldiers and losing 700 Israeli soldiers. Now, we all know that every soldier is a mother's son, and every death is tragic. At the same time, the ratio is quite dramatic. So they did all this while they were being attacked from the outside. Once again, the myth just doesn't work. Now, I have a picture here. This is my father when he was a general. And what's interesting is this. I think it's important to look at the historical perspective here. On the very last day, or the very first meeting, I should say, after the war was over, he was one of the generals, you know, during that war. On the very first meeting of the generals after the war, he said, now we have an opportunity to solve the Palestinian problem by allowing the Palestinians to establish their own state in the West Bank and Gaza. This was 1967. While he was saying this, Israel began immediately a massive campaign of destruction and ethnic cleansing, just as they did in 1948. Because in Israeli terms, that war completed the job. He was talking about a possibility of compromise and peace and a future where the two nations could somehow share their country in peace and then move on. The state of Israel was going in an entirely different direction, a direction that actually was in line with the Zionist philosophy and with the creation of the state of Israel, which meant there is no compromise on the land. It's a zero-sum game. In fact, this is what happened. The 1967 war completely erased Palestine off the map and placed Israel for good between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. Which is why when people talk about the possibility of an Israeli government one day giving up the West Bank for a Palestinian state, like I always say, if it wasn't so sad, it would be funny. It shows a complete, misunderstanding of what Zionism and the state of Israel are all about. The name of the game was conquering the land, erasing as much as possible Palestine from the map, and then ethnic cleansing and then de-Arabizing. De-Arabizing means changing the names, it means destroying monuments, and it means changing the history and changing the story. This country was an Arab country for 1,500 years, and it sits right at the heart of the Arab world. Yet the state of Israel is trying to make the connection, and if you heard Netanyahu's speech at the UN General Assembly, the connection between today's Israel and King David's biblical kingdom of Israel, which may or may not have existed, because there is no historical proof that the King David had ever existed. And this is the name of the game, and this is the process. The process that took part, that began in 1948, continued in 1967, with hundreds of thousands being kicked out, and once again, cities and towns and neighborhoods being destroyed, and this goes on to this day. To this very day, towns and villages and neighborhoods being destroyed and people being thrown out of their homes and the whole process of de-Arabizing the land. But these things have a cost. These things have a cost. Like you heard, in 1997, on September the 4th, my sister's little girl, Smadar, was killed. She was 13 years old, in a suicide attack in Jerusalem. And this is a shock of such proportions that really words can't do it justice. This was big news because she's the granddaughter of a famous general, but she was also the granddaughter of a man who talked about Palestinian rights and fought. He became really an advocate for Palestinian rights after he retired from the military. So this was big news. A lot of reporters came and so on and so forth, and a lot of people came to express their sorrow. And when my sister finally came out to meet everyone, she said two things. Because the first question people always ask is, what about retaliation and revenge? And her first comment was, no real mother would want to see this happen to any other mother. Don't talk to me about more killing and more death. And when she was asked who's responsible, who she sees responsible, she said, I see the Israeli government responsible, because these two young men killed themselves and took innocent civilians with them because they were brought to such a level of despair and hopelessness that they couldn't take it anymore. And this hopelessness and despair is a result of the brutal occupation, the violent oppression of Israel on the Palestinians. And this is why these things happen. So if you want to see the violence end, we need to stop this brutal oppression. We need to stop the occupation against Palestinians. People who see their homes destroyed, water being taken away, land being taken away, their future being taken away, their fathers and brothers being arrested and tortured and killed, this is what happens. Between the end of 1967 war and 1993, there was an ongoing dialogue between Israelis and the PLO, the official representatives of the Palestinians, in order to try to come up with some kind of a program that would work. It was a two-state solution, is what they talked about. My father was part of that, but it wasn't until 1993 that Israel was willing to participate in any kind of negotiations with the PLO. And they knew this was going on, and not only that, the Israeli government not only refused to participate, they outlawed the meetings with the PLO at one point. And in 1993, you wonder, what happened to Israel? What is it that Zionism suddenly changed? Did they all suddenly, what happened in 1993? Why did they decide to engage with the Palestinians? And if you look at the map, you'll see why. By 1993, they made absolutely certain, they knew for certain, that there was no chance that a Palestinian state could ever be established in the West Bank. Through settlements and rebuilding roads and highways and whatnot, just like they did after 1948 in the rest of the Palestine, they did in the West Bank, and it was absolutely certain, they were absolutely certain that there was not a chance Palestinians could establish a state in that land. And if you look at the map on your left, those little dark kind of tan marks, that is what they talk about when they talk about Palestinian state. This is Areas A. All the rest of the West Bank is full of settlements, and it's nobody ever thought of or ever considered ever allowing the Palestinians to establish a state there. And once again, like I said earlier, if anybody still thinks that Israel will ever make these concessions, it's absolutely absurd. And it's interesting because the myth is that the Palestinians are not willing to make concessions. The Palestinians made a massive concessions when they were talking about the two-state solution. Yasser Arafat made the biggest concession ever by giving his willingness to give up almost 80% of the land and the right of the refugees to return in order to allow Israelis and Palestinians to live in peace. You know, like you heard earlier, I came from a very patriotic Zionist family, and I learned all about all of this, rather late in life. The first time I ever met Palestinians, I was in San Diego. I was 39 years old. Because even though I was born and raised in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is supposedly a mixed city, it's a very racially divided city. It's completely segregated. And after my niece was killed, I felt like I had to do something. So I lived in San Diego at the time. I found a group of Jews and Palestinians, a dialogue group, which was an excellent group of people. And through that, I began learning about the process, about what happened, about the Nakba and the history and the narrative of the Palestinians. And it was a very difficult process, but they were very generous and kind in how they kind of led me into it. Because it's very difficult and very painful to hear that what you thought was always right turns out to be completely wrong. And then I began venturing into the West Bank and venturing into Palestinian communities in Israel and learning more about the issue. And this sign is something that if you've been to Palestine, as you cross the checkpoints, you see the sign every single time. And it's very interesting to read this sign. It says that this road, and this is, by the way, from Kalandia checkpoint. It says this road continues into Area A. leads into Area A, and Area A is under Palestinian control. And in the larger letter, it says that the entry for Israelis into Area A is forbidden, it threatens your life, and it is a felony. And if you're not impressed yet, there are two exclamation marks, not one, at the end of the statement. So if you haven't run the other way yet, the two exclamation marks, surely. Now, none of this, of course, is true unless you can read it, which means if you don't read Hebrew, it's not true. The good fortune that I had is that I didn't have the sense to run away when I saw this, but I ventured forward. And there are other Israelis and other people that do that as well. And when you cross to the other side, and every time I've done that over the last 10, 12 years, I still haven't seen it. I still haven't found it. I haven't found the danger. I haven't found that Palestinian who's waiting for me because I'm an Israeli who wants to kill me. All I see is kids going to school and traffic jams and shops and businesses and so on. I just see life. And I've been doing this for a very long time. And the conclusion that I reached over the years is that this sign and the wall and the soldiers and the terrorizing harassment that Palestinians go through when they cross the checkpoint or when they try to leave Israel through Tel Aviv airport has got nothing to do with anybody's safety or security. It's racist, and it's an attempt to keep one side afraid and one side frustrated and angry so that they will never come together. That is the whole purpose of the sign and the entire apartheid system that Israel has created. You know, the final remarks I'll make and the final chapter in my book talks about the future. You know, what do we do now? Israel has, in fact, created one state. So one state, two state is not really a conversation that we need to have anymore because it's not an option out of two. It is the reality that Israel created. Zionism created one state between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. It's a state that where different populations are governed by different laws. I'm an Israeli Jew. It's a complete free democracy for me. You've got Palestinians who are Israeli citizens, and there are over 30 laws in the law books that discriminate them, and there's a massive culture of discrimination against them and racism. And you've got the Palestinians in the West Bank who have no rights and no law that protects them at all. And with a very, very sophisticated racist education system, which my sister was an educator, just wrote a book about, with a bureaucracy, a massive bureaucracy that is dedicated to making life impossible for Palestinians, and with an army that I would categorize as probably one of the most best-financed, best-armed terrorist organizations in the world is the Israeli army. That is how Israel managed to maintain this one state. That's how it's being governed, which is why it's often compared to apartheid. The conversation we need to have now is how do we transform that racist apartheid state into a democracy with equal rights? Because if we're talking about solidarity with Palestinians, that's what we should be talking about, equal rights. The discussion on the two states provides the state of Israel a fig leaf to continue the ethnic cleansing and continue the discrimination and continue the de-Arabizing of the land. So that I would propose is the conversation we need to have. I want to end with a hopeful note. I think that, I not only think that, there's absolutely no question in my mind that once democracy is accomplished and Israelis and Palestinians can live together, do live together as equals, the pain and the difficulty and the anger and the fear will be very, very quickly moved out of the way and pushed out of the way once the two peoples realize that their mutual interests are far stronger, far more important. Israelis and Palestinians are very similar. They're two very similar societies, education levels and so on are all, you know, both societies have a very rich upper crust that's very corrupt, which they hate, they want to get rid of. And both societies have a fringe of fanatic, religious fanatic lunatics, which they want to get rid of. So moving forward, this will provide them hope and provide them a possibility to work together for a future where they can live. But it has to be a democracy with equal rights. All right, thank you all very much.